Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, thanks for joining me for episode 43 of A Small Voice, the last of 2016, a year that many of us will be pleased to see the back of, given the tumultuous political and humanitarian upheavals that it has brought us. If you personally had a great 2016 for whatever reason, maybe you became a parent or started a new job or did some good work or published a photo book or just did a lot of partying, then good, I salute you and congratulate you for giving all that other horrible 2016 shit the finger. I look forward to bringing you more conversations with photographers in the new year and beyond. Have fun, take care. Take pictures. This week I chat with Simon Roberts. Simon is a British photographer based in Brighton on the south coast of England, whose work deals with our relationship to landscape and notions of identity and belonging. Often employing expansive large format landscape photographs, his approach is one of creating wide-ranging surveys of our time which communicate on important social, economic and political issues. Simon is perhaps best known for his major long-term project We English, for which he undertook a nine-month road trip around England in a camper van accompanied by his pregnant wife and two-year-old daughter. The resulting work has been exhibited widely, touring to over 30 national and international venues, and was published as a book by Chris Boot and voted by Martin Parr as one of the best photography books of the past decade. He's had solo shows at the National Media Museum, Bradford, Museum of Contemporary Photography, Chicago, and Multimedia Art Museum, Moscow. His photographs reside in major public and private collections, including the George Eastman House, Deutsche Börse Art Collection, and Wilson Center for Photography. In recognition for his work, Simon has received several awards, including the Vic Odden Award, offered for a notable achievement in the art of photography by a British photographer, along with bursaries from the National Media Museum, John Coble Foundation, and grants from Arts Council England. He was commissioned as the official election artist by the House of Commons Works of Art Committee to produce a record of the 2010 general election on behalf of the UK Parliament. In 2012, he was granted access by the International Olympic Committee to photograph the London Olympics and most recently was made an honorary fellow of the Royal Photographic Society. As well as We English, he has published two other critically acclaimed monographs, Motherland, published by Chris Boot in 2007, and Peerdom, published by Dewey Lewis in 2013. We talked extensively about Motherland and We English, didn't really get around to Peerdom, but nevertheless, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Simon Roberts. Can you just let us know what you've been up to? You mentioned before I turned the recorder on that, you know, it's this plate spinning exercise that we will have to kind of negotiate, whereby you're working in different time frames, stuff you've done, stuff you want to do, and stuff you're trying to do now. I think that's a really interesting thing to sort of mention.
Yeah, one of the aspects or the unique aspects of this part of the job, I suppose, is that you are trying to make the most of work you've already made. And I think that's one thing that we often fail at as practitioners, is that we kind of make something, we launch it and we think then that's it. But actually it's really important to make as much life as possible out of work you've already created. So, you know, I've just finished an exhibition of Peerdom, which, you know, the work was finished 3 years ago, but I've been exhibiting it in various forms since. And we've just finished a show of the actually on Hastings Pier, which to some extent almost feels like it's the most important or most the best representation of the work to actually have it outdoors on one of these structures where, you know, that I've been photographing. Yeah. So that was really interesting. And then at the same time, I'm looking forward to, you know, finishing projects or researching future projects, and then, you know, dealing with museums and galleries for things 2 or 3 years down the line, and then at the same time also trying to make work now and earn a living and survive. So there's this strange time frame where you're looking forwards, backwards, and trying to live in the moment. So in terms of the moment, I'm making work for a public arts commission for the Thames Tideway Tunnel, which is this capital building project where they're creating a new tunnel under London to help the sewage system, which is running at capacity in London.
Yeah, I've heard
but
about
as
this.
Part of this, you know, there's a large number of public arts commissions that they're taking place along this 8-year building project. So I've just received one to make work for a 50-metre hoarding along outside Embankment Tube. So it's very different from the kind of work I normally do. It's something as approached to put in a pitch, and I thought I'd give it a go, and
right,
and got it, and now making work which is very different to what I normally make. Yeah. I'm not going to tell you about it because I'm not allowed to, but right, it'll be interesting secret when it launches,
yeah, okay,
in March. And then I've just finished a project in Switzerland, which was a commission for a museum in Winterthur, and that was a group exhibition which will launch in February, and a book. So that's, it's kind of nice to be at a stage where we're about to launch something. I always like this period where the book's signed off, the work's been made, it's now being framed, and we're just waiting for it to go on the wall. So it's quite a nice period, really, to run into Christmas.
Yeah. And in terms of things like this Thames Tideway thing, do you keep an eye out for opportunities, or you just, you know, people let you know about these things that you can apply for?
A bit of both, really. This actually came out of the blue. So this was one of those nice ones where I was just approached. Actually, I didn't get the first one. I was put forward, or I was asked to put in a pitch a couple of years ago for one of the commissions, and I had an interview, and somebody else got the right commission. You know, so you put in all that work and you don't get it, and you think, oh, damn. But yeah, then, you know, 2 years later they came back and I put in another pitch for another site, and they accepted it. So it's always worth persevering.
Yeah.
I try and keep an eye on, you know, new competitions or grants that are running, but it's, you know, it's very difficult to manage that at the same time as managing everything else. But I think it is very important to keep an eye on these things,
yeah,
particularly at a younger stage in your career where you're looking for every opportunity you can to reach a new audience or find new way of funding work.
Yeah, and more so now than ever, probably, because, you know, those kind of traditional means of earning money have dried up to some extent, and you know, what used to be a slightly more kind of unusual approach, i.e. getting grants and these kind of commissions, you know, has become possibly, you know, more commonly the way to go. But I think it's, you know, the thing you're saying about making the most of stuff you've already shot, because when you spent, you know, a number of years on one particular project, you know, it's a hell of a lot of time that you've invested in that thing. And it's kind of crazy to then just go, oh, well, that's done, and then to sort of leave it as if it's going to, you know, we'll find a life of its own to some extent. But you've really got to keep on kind of milking it as much,
yeah,
as you possibly can.
Yeah, and I think there's nothing wrong with leveraging work you've already made.
Not at all.
I mean, weirdly, I've seemed to have exhibited my Pollyanna Nocci work, which is the Polar Nights work that I made in Russia 10 years ago. I seem to have exhibited that almost every Christmas. You know, right. It's that kind of, yeah, you know, it's to some form or another, somebody approaches me to ask whether they can show some of that work.
And yeah,
that's, you know, that's, I always like, you know, wheeling it out of the studio,
of,
and, you know, it's frames I don't have to store for a few months.
Yeah,
but
course,
also there's an opportunity there for people to see the work again, and for me to hopefully sell some of it.
I mean, you're really kind of on it as far as having representation goes, you know, different people in different parts of the world and stuff. Now, is that something that you have kind of consciously, you know, worked at establishing, or has that just sort of happened naturally as time's gone on?
Well, I think it's an organic process, but of course you have to plant the seeds for it to then, you know, bear some fruit. Pardon the bad analogy, but
yeah.
So there is a form of game plan, but I don't think you can. I don't think it's heavily planned in the sense that you just have to let things happen. I mean, there's a kind of certain vision that I have, and I think it's always important to have a 2-3-4 year plan in place, because otherwise you're not really sure what you're moving towards. And so I always have a kind of sense of where I'd like my work to be down the line. It doesn't always happen, but I think it gives you an opportunity to make more important decisions than you would just on the hoof. And of course things change over time in terms of the gallery's situation. That's changing slightly now. I've actually just moved to a new gallery, to Flowers Gallery in New York. So you know, I'm trying to actually simplify things a little bit, because it was actually getting to the point where it became quite complicated managing several galleries with additions and different edition numbers and all this thing. And actually, it gets to the stage where it'd be quite nice to simplify my life.
Yeah, yeah.
But not just that, but just, I think, keep things fresh. And my relationship with Flowers Gallery is one that's actually very important to me. And there, I found it to be quite a nurturing environment. Mm. And that's something that I really want to continue. Mm. And hopefully we can both benefit from that relationship. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, this job is no different to any others. It's all about relationships. It's about how, who you know and how you get on. And, you know, you want to work with people that you like, and enjoy the process, because otherwise, why are we doing it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, absolutely. And so it's not just about finding representation, but it's about finding the right people, the people who,
yeah,
you know, are just who are right for you personally.
And you're not just using each other, I think.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about planning. So you are quite a planner, because I mean, I think some people are very sort of, you know, sometimes you're in a kind of reactive, kind of almost a firefighting mode, whereby you're just trying to deal with the stuff that's happening. And, you know, I think maybe, you know, planning for the future is something that gets overlooked to some extent, but that's something that clearly you're quite, you know, you're kind of prioritizing. At least,
well, to be honest, I have three children and a mortgage. You know, I have to, you know, there is no other position to be in other than being a good planner.
Sure.
Because, you know, I have to survive, you know, I've got, you know, mouths to feed, etc. So I think it changes on the time of your career. I think I'm in a particular place where I have to work in a certain way. You know, 10 years ago when I started Motherland, there was my wife and I. We could, you know, we were Footloose and Fancy Free. We could go off to Russia and spend a year. And then with We English, you know, we could spend 7 months on the road. That's not possible now. So the way that I create work has to change with my position that I'm in.
Sure.
Domestically. And, you know, my family is very important, and I have to make that work over my career. But at some stage the children will be at school, and then things will change again. So I'm enjoying making work in a different way than I have done in the past. And I think you just have to make each period of your life work for the position that you're currently in.
Yeah. So what is that different way? I mean, how does
I suppose that it's, you know, in the past I would make work very intensely. So I, you know, travel for a year and make photographs every day. And whereas now, I mean, I suppose it started with Peerdom, which was, it was a big project, but it was made over 3 years. I didn't, you know, I wasn't on the road constantly. I was able to work around other things.
And it was something you could do here in the UK.
And it was something I could do here in the UK. But generally speaking, I have found it, you know, I've made a decision that I want to make an extended survey in Britain. So Peerdom was just another piece of a bigger jigsaw of work that I'm making about Britain.
Yeah.
And that's something I'm continuing. And I can do that in little bursts rather than one.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Period. Yeah. I mean, I guess when I was talking about the planning, I wasn't thinking so much about, you know, in terms of earning a living, which is obviously, as you say, incredibly important when you've got three kids and a mortgage, or whether you haven't. But in terms of, I guess, making sure that you are trying to steer the ship in, you know, in a direction that's good for you, rather than just letting yourself be kind of battered around from one place to another. Because you could still earn a very healthy living quite easily, especially at your stage in career. But, you know, if you don't keep an eye on making sure, you know, you're doing the work you want to do, then that, you know, can be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly could have slipped into doing much more commercial work. I mean, I hardly do any commercial work. Actually, I can't remember the last time I did a commercial job. And that's not to say I wouldn't do it if it was offered, but I'm not actively seeking.
Sure.
And it is really important that I'm able to sustain making my own practice, which, of course, you know, we all talk about that tightrope of the art and commerce. You know, how do you walk that line where you can be making your own work but also be making a living from it? And, of course, we all want to be in the position where we can do that. And I think it's, each of us has to find a way of doing that. I personally think we have to be very nimble these days. You can't rest on your laurels. You can't think that one avenue is going to be there for you for the next 5 or 6 years. So I'm always thinking about possible new ways of making work or earning a living, but, you know, but at the same time focusing solely on my practice. Mm-mm. So whether that's funding it through Arts Council grants, or whether it's funding it through doing chapters where a magazine might help, or whether it's getting selling prints through a, you know, with a private donor that can help me, you know, make a new right. part of the work. But generally, planning, of course, it's most of the job, not just in terms of planning where your work's going, but planning each particular project. And I think it's really important that there's as much planning is put in place beforehand, so that you're as clear as possible about what the expectations are. So, for instance, with the election project, where the commission that I got with Parliament to make work for the 2010 general election, that could have been an abject failure if I'd just not planned it and just kind of rocked up and spent right. a month travelling around the country trying to make work about the election. Mm. So I spent 3 months researching it, planning it, working out where I was going to, you know, what I was interested in, what I thought was going to be of particular value, which constituencies I wanted to travel to, which politicians I wanted to focus on. And, you know, I had people involved in that, both students and a researcher who was particularly interested in politics, that I could use their knowledge and to make that thing a success, because right. because otherwise, you know, it just could have fallen flat.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think it is... we have so much information at our fingertips now. It's actually very easy to do a lot of this planning. Mm. You know, in the past, you got a commission to go to, I don't know, to Zimbabwe, and you wouldn't have Google Maps, yeah. Google Earth,
you have to go to the
Google
library.
Street View, you know, all this stuff that you could reference to get a visual picture of what you might expect in this place, in this particular area that you're going to photograph, or... So you can draw on all of these references now much easier, which gives you a better sense of what you might find when you get there. And of course, it's always slightly different, but the more information that you have at your disposal, the easier it becomes, and you can kind of work quicker and you can work more efficiently.
Yeah, yeah. So you can make your life a lot easier by doing the work in advance. But do you actively enjoy that stuff, or is it just a sort of necessary evil when it comes to the planning stage?
No, I enjoy it, but of course I'd rather be out shooting more.
Yeah.
I think we're all in that position where if we had a kind of full team behind us that could be doing a lot of the legwork, it would certainly make things easier.
But for instance, with Motherland, which, you know, was this kind of epic road trip you did around the Soviet Union, tell me a little bit about how you went about planning for that.
Well, it's actually just Russia. So we went
Russia,
around,
sorry, yeah,
yeah. So it was a Russian Federation. So it was none of the Soviet states.
Right.
Like Tajikistan and Kazakhstan. But yeah, I mean, that was at least 18 months to a year's planning. A lot of that was because I didn't want to have any, I didn't want to be working on any kind of agenda. So therefore I needed to self-finance it. Mm. So, you know, a lot of the planning was actually just financial planning to be allowed to let myself spend that amount of time traveling. But then things like, I knew I needed to have some official accreditation. So how was I going to get accreditation from the Russian Foreign Ministry, which in the end took a huge amount of work and stress, but was very important to have in the end.
Right.
Thinking about how Russia had been represented in photography, particularly in the years prior to us going, since the fall of communism. So you're looking at a lot of, I think I probably bought every book I could find, photography based about Russia. But then extending that beyond, you know, there was a number of exhibitions in London there's a big one, I think it was the Royal Academy, that looking at Russian landscape painting that was loaned from the Tretyakov Gallery. Learning Russian, you know, although my wife spoke it, I did lessons beforehand.
Yeah, because she studied there, didn't she?
She studied Russian and English at Sheffield University.
Oh,
but
right.
Part of that was spending a year living in Russia.
Okay, so that was her degree.
And she did Russian at school, so she'd spent a lot of time there, but wanted to... That was really just in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So for her, it was an opportunity to travel as well and explore this country that, you know, she knew much better than I did and had much more of an intimate connection with it, and felt 10 years after graduating that it's somewhere that she really wanted to look at. And she was at a point where wanted to explore a new avenue. So she actually was writing a book about our travels as well, or about the experiences. So, you know, between us, it was both an opportunity to explore a different, for her, a different craft, but for me to hone my craft, because I felt that up until that point, I'd not really given myself enough time to, it's a corny phrase, but explore my voice in photography and that idea of authorship. And it was actually during the, I got on the World Press Masterclass in 2003, where they every year they select 10 photographers from around the world to go on this kind of intense week tutoring with various mentors, and it was really powerful experience. And a lot of the mentors, you know, all talked about how, you know, while I was a good photographer and I could take good pictures, they found it difficult to find what my real interests were, where my passions lie.
Right.
And that, you know, that I was needed more time to explore that. And it was very difficult doing that in London, working on magazine assignments and where you might have a week or 2 weeks, but generally speaking, you're just chasing your tail. So this was a time where I can just say, okay, here we go. Let me.
Yeah. Your first real proper just, kind of long term.
Yeah. And just have total freedom to make photographs. Mm.
Well, look, let's fill in that gap then, as it were, because I want to come back to Motherland, but I think we can maybe go back in time a little bit. Before that, then you were sort of freelancing, like, as you say, as doing magazine commissions and that kind of thing. And I think it was you won the Ian Parry Award, you know, one of the awards that's kind of important for young documentary photographers in this country. You know, it's that one of those kind of ones that if you're doing a photography course at college or something, you're probably going to want to, you know, enter it. Yeah, how did that change things for you? Did you recognize at the time that that was a kind of a big break, as it were, or did you see it as a big break?
Yeah, because I at that time I was studying Sheffield. I'd finished studying human geography at Sheffield University, and then I knew that I wanted to go in photography and had done a lot of photography at school. And so once I graduated, I applied for the LCC and various other courses. And I was offered a place in London. But then actually, when I kind of looked at the sums of money it was going to cost me living in London, and then I realized it was a course in Sheffield, I thought, oh, well, I'll stay in Sheffield and do the NCTJ.
Because you're already up there.
Yeah. So this National Council for Training of Journalists, which was basically a news photography course. And it was difficult. I realized very quickly that I wasn't a news photographer and I wasn't interested in becoming a news photographer. However, it was very useful in terms of the toolbox of learning about copyright law and learning about how to sniff out a story and how to work quickly on your feet and be reactive and get to know picture editors. So there was a lot of very good grounding there. And I got a job as a local stringer for a news agency covering South Yorkshire, and I did that for about 6 months. But while I remember one of the things that Paul Delmar, who ran the course, told me, he said that, and I think he knew that I wasn't interested in news photography, and he said to me, look, what you need is you need a project. Go and find a project that you can work on while you're doing your other pictures here with me, and just, you know, just enjoy that process. And so that's when I started making this work about Daniel Teasdale, who was a young boxer and who trained under Prince Nazim. And at the time, Prince Nazim was, you know, the world champion and a big star. And but Daniel was being touted as the next big thing. So for me, there was this interesting story about expectation and this young, very impressionable kid being weighed down with this sense that he could be great.
Mm.
And how does one cope with that? And this was almost kind of pre-X Factor and that sense that everybody grows up wanting to be famous, you know, right, which has become so much part of our culture now that we all expect, or there's this kind of sense that fame is something to be sought after.
Right.
And And so, yeah, it was really just a series about this young kid and how he managed that expectation. But he also tap danced, so for me there was this twist on the usual boxing story.
That gave it another dimension.
Yeah, definitely. And Paul Del Mar said, "Oh, you should enter it to the Impari Award," and I entered it, and like you say, it won. And what that meant was that I then left Sheffield and moved to London and began working alongside the Sunday Times magazine as a freelancer. And Aidan Sullivan was one of those key people in the industry. You know, he's one of the last kind of great picture editors, along with somebody like Cheryl Newman and Susan Glenn and Victoria Lukens. You know, this group of very passionate, Colin Jacobson, these passionate picture editors who were working in the 80s and 90s for these magazines that really were still working on, you know, trying to get great stories, photo stories into magazines, which of course we know what happened, you know. Latterly, a lot of these have now gone, but in terms of the number of pages that you get and the type of stories that are being used. So Aidan was very nurturing in terms of helping me understand, you know, how to create photo stories. And so that was a really important time, you know, 1988, 1999, I began shooting. And I realized quickly also that the value of ideas and actually not waiting to be commissioned, and that you needed to kind of come up with, generate ideas and research and find out about things and go off and shoot stories and then try and sell them afterwards. So I never kind of sat around and waited to be given work. I was always pushing quite hard. And I think often the stories were rejected, but having offered something and having it rejected, they at least saw that I was passionate and was interested, and then they would often give me a commission. So it was kind of a two-way process.
No downside in a way to that, because you're getting used to that process of being rejected without sort of taking it too personally. But also you had those contacts, you know, it was nice. You were in a position that you had people that you could pitch those ideas to. There was no kind of, who do I have to, you know, call? And that having kind of won the Impari, that I guess that gave you the introduction, as it were. But you, I guess the thing is that you took full advantage of it. I mean, you did move to London. Was there a plan at that stage? Coming back to the plan question,
I knew I was going to move to London. I knew that the magazines was a more interesting way of making work for me. So that was certainly part of the plan. A very influential figure in my career was a friend called Greg Williams, who grew up in Oxted, where I grew up. And he left Oxford County, the school that I went to, and went to LCC and did photography, and then was shooting for Oxfam and doing. He did a lot of kind of war photography and was doing some pretty hardcore photojournalist stuff. And every summer or Christmas break, I'd come back from Sheffield and, you know, having done another 4 months of politics and sociology, and he'd be regaling stories of, you know, just coming back from Somalia or, you know, America or wherever he'd been, and, you know, just sounded so glamorous. And you know, I never kind of lost that connection. And so when I then moved to London, Greg decided to set up an agency called Growbag, and the idea was that we were going to be a group of photographers that could kind of work together and help one another, and also he represent artists and other forms of visual media, and between us we could try and, I think they called it cross-pollinization, you know, between us we could, and this is the beginning of the dot-com boom, and so there was a lot of kind of passionate people around. There was money there for investment, and so we set up. You know, Greg set this agency up. I joined, and it was an exciting time. You know, early 2000s to be making work, and we were syndicating work to magazines directly. So we weren't using foreign agents. So we shoot a story for the Sunday Times and sell it straight to Parry Match or Stern or South China Morning Post. And a number of people joined us, like Tom Craig and Simon Norfolk and Poppy Berry, and it was a really exciting time.
Be
in London, and Greg was one of these passionate people that was just had an energy about him and about the work he was making and about what he wanted to do. And that was very infectious. And I think we all of us, you know, took some of that with us.
Well, yeah, because you had and all those people you've mentioned were sort of, you know, also top rate. So, you know, there was a sense of, you know, camaraderie, I suppose. But also when you're surrounded by other people who are also, you know, operating, you know, at a high level, I guess, did it encourage you to sort of, was there a slight, you know, impetus to raise your game or to...
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But I think we all had our own avenues, so there was it never felt like we were being that we were competing with one another. But yeah, we could talk about stories, we could talk about ideas, we could talk about subjects that we were interested in, and so and there were, as I said before, there were magazine picture editors around us that were also interested in these things.
Right. Yeah. And it's nice to have those people. It's nice to have that sense of, yeah, you know, kind of people to bounce ideas off and to, because otherwise you can end up very isolated, I think. And if you've got a little group like that, it's kind of, did that feel, that must have felt good.
Yeah, it felt very good. I mean, somebody, you know, I remember I shot a story on the snowbirds, which are these elderly Americans that head south in winter in America. So they, you know, they basically, it's like the migration of birds, the temporary migration. They come down to Texas and if you're from Montana and Idaho, and they live this kind of mobile existence in motorhomes, and then they go back in the summer, head north. And I shot this story, and I did it in two chunks. I shot a little bit in October, and then I went back. I was focusing on a particular town which had a very small population, and then in January over 500,000 elderly Americans turn up in motorhomes. I wanted to show the kind of transition of this tiny town in the desert. And in the first trip I went, I'd taken two Canon bodies with a zoom lens and a wide angle, and, you know, all of these bits and pieces. And then I also kind of picked up a Bronica and took that with a couple of rolls of black and white. And I shot, I think, something like 70 rolls of color transparency on my Canon, and then I shot five rolls of black and white on the Bronica. And I remember going to see Aidan Sullivan, and he patiently went through every single sheet of transparencies. It was a huge pile, and I remember him, he just kind of shoved this pile to one side, and then he took out the Bronica, the six, you know, the black and whites, and he said, in this selection of 50 pictures, you're telling a better story than you are in this mountain of...
Right.
And the reason was because with the Bronica, I had one camera, I had one lens, and I wasn't thinking about the equipment. All I was concentrating on was the moment, was look, what was I looking at? What was the picture? What was the focus of why I was there? Whereas with the Canon, I, you know, I was zooming in and out. I was, you know, I was being an illustrator. I wasn't being an author. And I remember clearly, he said, go back and just use that one camera and that one lens. And I went back and I felt so free, not having to worry about all this other stuff. And it was so liberating. And pretty much to that day, I only work with one camera and one lens.
Right.
Now, so the camera changes, and I always have a spare lens. But the point, I mean, so when I went to Russia, I mean, I had a Mamiya 7 and two lenses. I mean, that was it. I mean, I did have a small digital camera, but that was really just to be able to give people pictures as I was traveling.
So that was one of those big kind of inflection points where you learned something important about how you should proceed.
Just and actually, the equipment is to some extent inconsequential. You know, don't worry about that. You got to know it inside out, but it's really about yourself and the subject. So even when I was shooting Wee English, and I was, you know, it was a 4x5 and a 150 lens, it was just that. It was just a way of recording the landscape that I was looking at. So I was much more engaged with thinking about the place, thinking about the composition, thinking about what was taking place within the frame, and really kind of engaging much more in that aspect of being part of the scene, if you like. So really kind of becoming part of the photograph.
And really just using whatever camera is the right tool for that particular job, you know, to get the result that you're looking to get.
Yeah.
We'll come back to Wee English, I think. I'm jumping around the kind of... timeline here, but just before we move on. At that stage when you were freelancing, was there any particular sort of spreads that you got that kind of alerted people to your kind of presence, that, you know, beyond just like stuff that you'd got in the Sunday Times magazine, were there any particular commissions that were kind of, you know, big ones for you?
I suppose the biggest story that I did in terms of traction was that I managed to get access to this event called Desert Blast, which is was an annual gathering of clandestine pyromaniacs in the Nevada desert. And it's very much that, as we all know, the hardest things to get access to often have the biggest exposure. So it had never been photographed before, other than the pyrotechnics themselves. And of course, this was pre-social media, pretty much pre-internet, you know.
Yeah.
And so I saw a picture from one of the snowbirds, actually, was showing me some pictures of his holiday snaps, and one of them was this event. And I said, you know, I'd love to photograph this. So it took me about 6 months to get permission from the organizer. And they said, yes, you can come as long as you don't give him anybody's identity away. And so the Sunday, I told Aidan, he said, it sounds a bit weird to me, but I'll buy you a flight, you know, get you to Las Vegas, see what you can do. And sure enough, I got there and it was just the wackiest thing that I'd ever seen. And, you know, there was a couple of hundred people with submachine guns, dynamites, all kinds of paraphernalia, and in their own words, spent 24 hours blowing shit up. and I knew at the time that I needed to make as many pictures as possible, because it was such a kind of weird event. And this is 1999. And, you know, the Sunday Times published it when I got back, did a very good spread. And then within 2 years, sold it to, I don't know, 25, 30 foreign magazines, you know, Life, Stern, Parimatch. Yeah. You know, Norway, Sweden. So I mean, it was just extraordinary.
Yeah, you got your reward. In a way, you got your reward for that sort of determination to, you know, pursue the permission and all that. You know, to stick with it. I guess that's a lesson learned there. You know, if you're committed, then sometimes things work out really well.
But also the importance of controlling your copyright. Not just your copyright, your license. And of course, it is getting difficult, more difficult these days, with magazine groups trying to control your license. So, for instance, Condé Nast, who owns several magazines, you know, and magazines in different territories. So there's more than one GQ that want you to sign contracts that might restrict how much you can resell that work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's important to try and control as much of that of your, you know, intellectual property as possible.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, because I think, as we started out by saying, it's important to be able to, you know, it's important to be able to resell stuff once you've, you know, invested time and money in shooting it. So back to Motherland, which was, as you say, you know, this kind of your first departure from doing those kind of magazine-y type things and doing something much more kind of ambitious in terms of its scope. What inspired you to do that project?
Mainly my wife, I have to be honest. I mean, she had wanted to go back to Russia for a long time, and I was looking for this big project, and once she mentioned it, I thought, well, I'll start looking at photography, and realized that actually so much of it was following a particular dialogue, which was that sense of the collapse of the Soviet Union. So a lot of the pictures were black and white, of course, looked at decay and collapse and the end of something. And it really felt like things hadn't moved beyond that stereotype. You know, there were some people working in color, like Luc Delahaye's, you know, famous book. But even that kind of had this sense of depression about it.
Very depressing book.
Winter Arms. You know, amazing, but yeah,
very fantastic.
You know.
But, yeah.
And then, you know, there was Karl de Kaiser's Zona, and you know, several Magnum photographers had done a lot. You know, Gerd Ludwig. Of course, very little work we were seeing from Russian photographers, and that was partly because there wasn't the mechanisms for them to get it out. There weren't really any agencies. I mean, photographer.ru started about 2004 and you know, became much bigger, 2006, 2007, 2008, when they really started trying to get Russian photography out of Russia. But prior to that, it just felt that something different could be said, and I thought I'd give it a go.
Right, right.
And wanted to look at colour, wanted to look at not just landscape but portraiture, and but that horrible phrase, you know, objectivity. And you know, I wanted a sense of objectivity while knowing, of course, this is my representation of Russia.
In terms of the subjects that you came across, was it more or less a matter of just meeting strangers? And I think partly it was that you stayed with families, didn't you, rather than in hotels. Was that an important...
Yeah, that was important. Element. I mean, a lot of it, when I say a lot of it was planned, actually the actual journey was very unplanned.
Oh, okay.
And that was deliberate, because I wanted to challenge my own preconceptions. Of course, I'd had my own cultural baggage of, you know, what Russia was or what it might look like. And I didn't want to represent my own stereotypes. So it really was trying to respond to things when once we were on the ground, and a lot of that was based around staying with Russian families. So we used an early form of couch surfing called Hospitality Club, and a lot of Russian families were on this site, and it was just a way of staying with a family and engaging or seeing their city or town or village through their eyes rather than through mine or the Lonely Planet guide.
Yeah.
And it was a good way to get into schools and hospitals or youth clubs or AIDS charities or football club, or, you know, churches, whatever it was.
Yeah.
It was just a quick way of engaging in a very different part of society than you would as a tourist. I mean, it's that idea of being a traveller, not a tourist.
Right,
you know,
right.
That you're trying to move beyond the cultural baggage that you take.
I mean, can you think of any specific examples where that really stood you in good stead in terms of a picture that resulted that you would never have got otherwise?
One of the families we stayed with in Omsk, their daughter was in the All-Russian Ballroom Dance Contest.
Right.
And so we went along to that, and that was, you know, great rich pickings. I mean, I took some lovely portraits of these, you know, these young ballroom dancers, and the Russians take it very seriously.
Yeah.
And that's never something I would have come across,
right,
if I hadn't been staying with that family, or going into one of the universities with the professor that we were staying with. So there was a number of opportunities that came about purely thanks to the people we were staying with.
No, I think it's a really good trick, and I think it's something that quite a few people seem to have used, you know, that whole thing of, you know, trying to integrate in a very sort of, in a hurry, really. You're operating on a different level straight away by staying with people who actually live there.
I mean, one of the comments that people made was like, why did you have to travel the whole of Russia? Couldn't you have done this in one town? Why does it have to be so epic? And the reason it's got to be so epic is because we are talking about the largest country in the world, and we're looking at comparisons. I mean, what is the difference between Russia, 11 time zones from one end to the other? And I wanted to make these comparisons, which is why I shot the portraits in a very particular way. And of course, you could see when you go through it that there's a deliberate reference to August Sander and his work in Germany with the early 20th century. You know, that process of cataloguing, if you like. Now, why I haven't categorized people in the way that he did, but there is that form of stripped down deadpan portraiture which runs through the book,
mm-hmm.
you know, using a similar color palette. But then what changes is just what people are wearing or how they're inhabiting space, or the references in terms of architecture. But also there's a consistency, and you realize actually one of the amazing things about the Soviet project was actually how it managed to unify this enormous place. And it still staggers me that, you know, you can find the same Lenin statue almost in Vladivostok as you can in Kaliningrad,
right,
to this day.
What are the ones, were there any, what are the interactions that kind of have stayed with you? Do you remember specifically some of the people that you photographed in here? I'm flicking through it now in case...
Well, near the beginning of the book, there's two characters called Sasha and Pavel, and they were...
These guys?
Yeah. And they, he worked in the oil industry, and Sasha, I think, was worked on the fishing fleets, and they were old friends in Kamchatka. Kamchatka is a volcanic peninsula in Far East Russia that was one of the most important military bases in the Soviet Union. And the reason being is it was so close to the western seaboard of America that this is where a number of the missiles were hidden, pointing at Hawaii and Alaska, etc. So it was completely closed until the mid-90s. Even to Russians, you had to have a special permit to travel there. But it's just this extraordinary landscape. And every year, Sasha and Pavel go on their kind of road trip or field trip, if you like, into the mountains. And we were introduced to them but actually by an American expat that was running this little tourist company. And she was saying, oh, if you really want to experience Russia, you need to head off with these two crackpots. And so we spent 5 days horse trekking, right, which was really quite a tough experience given Sarah had never been on a horse.
So your wife was with you,
yeah,
on this.
And I'd rarely been on a horse, and it was pretty tough terrain, and it's sometimes humorous, sometimes downright annoying trying to keep up with these two Russian cowboys. But it was also such a spellbinding experience because they were such passionate characters about their country, about what it meant to be Russian, about what the Russian landscape meant to them, about how they existed in this place. And they exchanged this particular cultural experience with us, which was very enriching, very intense, but it really kind of stayed with us. And what I felt most was this palpable sense of what it meant to be Russian and what they felt, and this connection to the land and this connection to history and this melancholy, if you like, that Russians often experience. You know, they talk about the modest beauty because, you know, it's not about the glamour and the glory and the, it's about the ordinariness. It's about the banality. It's about the silver birch forest and the pastel colors, and this was something that stayed with me, and I wanted to really try and show it through my photographs. Yeah. So while I'm not trying to spin some propaganda with this book, I am trying to give it this sense of melancholy in terms of the way that it's certainly not a series of postcards.
No.
One of the things that's been most rewarding about the work is the reaction from Russians, and particularly expats who've seen it and have talked about how this enacts a certain sense of how they remember this place that they've left, and that they can, even though they've traveled to very few of the places that I've traveled to, you know, they might just have been born in Yaroslav and stayed in Yaroslav and then come to London or wherever it might be, there's this sense of this place that they know and that they understand, and I think for me that was what's been most enjoyable about.
Right. Well, work. Yeah, because I was going to ask you, you know, did you feel happy that you'd achieved that aim, as it were? But I guess getting that kind of feedback from the natives is as good a validation as you could hope for in terms of what you were trying to achieve. Were you pleased with the end result?
Yeah, and I have to, you know, thank Chris Boots for supporting it.
It's a lovely book. I mean,
it's, you know, at the time I wanted it to be bigger and bolder and more of a coffee table, and Chris was like, no, we need to keep it smaller. This is a visual diary. You know, you want people to sit with it and go through this, your journey with you, and have text on the same page so that they can engage with the people they're looking at. And you know, the more I sit with it, the more I'm kind of happy with the form that it's taken. And working with Fuel, the designers, was really enjoyable. And I think they did a great job with the cover and gave it this identity, which, as you can see through a number of my books, has continued. And that's something that has been important.
I kind of see what you mean, and of course you got an opportunity to make a much bigger book with We English, but something lovely about a book that you can kind of hold in your hand comfortably, and I don't kind of want for anything bigger. I can't remember what I was going to say. Oh, I know what I was going to say. If anyone wants a copy of Motherland, tough, because it's all sold, right? I mean, you can't really. I'm probably picking up somewhere.
Secondhand copies on Amazon, right. But
okay.
It was one of the big mistakes I made. Actually, Martin Parr said to me, so how many copies have you got stowed away? And I was like, oh, about 15. And he said, you should have had at least 50. And so with all the other books, I've made sure that I have a little stack for a rainy day.
That was a lesson learned.
That was
then,
a
at
lesson
least.
Learned, yes.
So yeah, let's go on to We English, because I suppose it's the project that you're probably best known for. And you know, you decided to explore your own home, as it were. So again, how did the idea sort of form initially?
Well, initially it was coming back on 7/7. I mean, the day that I landed in Britain,
really,
was the day of the terrorist attacks in London. And what was particularly strange was that the day before, we'd been packing up in Moscow and watching the television, and it was the day that the Olympics was announced, and there was this huge euphoria in Trafalgar Square, and it looked like the nation was just about to burst with pride. The next morning, we're stuck on the tarmac at Heathrow Airport for 3 or 4 hours, not being able to leave the plane because of what was taking place in London. So there was this extraordinary shift from a moment of euphoria to a moment of terror. And then watching the dialogue post 7/7, you know, this sense of upheaval and discussion about how did this happen? What was going on? Why was this terror in our midst? You know, particularly when it was found out that they were British born. And then of course, around that, we also had the debate with devolution. So there was discussion starting about Scotland maybe going for a referendum vote. There was more devolving powers in Wales. And I just thought, gosh, what country have I come back to? Mm. Having left this place that felt very secure about what Russia was. And of course, this is something that Putin's just played with in the decades since, you know. So I thought, well, this should be something that I begin making work about, you know, having come back to this place seemingly in chaos. And also, of course, it's often the largest country that has the less sense of who it is in a union. So actually, to some extent, it was the English that had less sense of what it meant to be English compared to Scotland, Wales,
right.
and even to some extent Northern Ireland.
Which is why you focused on England rather than.
And so I thought this was a perfect opportunity to politically make a statement and say, well, I'm going to look at England at this time, and what does this place mean, and how do people think about England, and how does that play into notions of identity and nationhood? And at the same time, there was a show at Tate Modern, How We Are Photographing Britain. You know, a real kind of seminal show to have it take Britain, but also to have this kind of history through decades looking at British photography and how it's related to itself. And of course, we got to the last room and the last decade, and it seemed that it was a bit all over the place. Who was looking at Britain and what were we doing? And it didn't seem to be the big voices that there had been.
Right, there was a gap almost there.
Yeah, there was, and I think that's partly my generation, the cheap flight generation, which we, you know, and the lure of the exotic and going abroad. And we weren't as political. I mean, we weren't born of that generation of the 60s and early 70s. I mean, okay, I'm 74, but really I'm the, you know, born of the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't as angry as the Paul Grahams and the Martin Parrs and the Chris Killips,
right,
and the Anna Foxes, you know, who were making quite political work about, you know, about Thatcherism and then coming out of this period of...
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much just about old enough to be a kind of one of Thatcher's children, but you're that bit younger than me, so you were sort of post-Thatcher.
Yeah, and I grew up in Surrey in the stockbroker belt in a, you know, middle-class family surrounded by Conservative Party tea parties, you know, although thankfully my mother's very Labour, so you know, I always had this other voice in my ear, you mm-hmm. know, which kind of challenged the Oxted, which is where I grew up, dialogue of isn't everything rosy and lovely, and so it was interesting looking at that timeline of British photography and saying, actually, this is time to be making work. This is really important. And then I remember looking at Tony Ray Jones thinking, here is a character that's been in America. He's been making work in America, you know, alongside Winogrand and Friedlander. And he's come back to his country and he can see the seeping change that's happening as a result of Americanization, if you like. And he thought, well, I'm going to make some work about British customs. And he made that seminal body of work. And I went to the National Media Museum and I looked at his diaries, and it was fascinating kind of entering into his thought process. And that was really an important moment where I thought, this is now something I have to do. I need to make a similar journey that I did in mm-hmm. Russia, but around my own country. And it took, you know, it took another 18 months to actually make it happen. I couldn't afford to do what I did with Motherland and just self-fund it. This needed to have support, right, which I got through a bursary through the National Media Museum and through the Arts Council. And at this stage, I began working with the Photographers Gallery. So they had been selling prints from Motherland, and the collectors, you know, had really embraced the work, and as a result, I was able to build up some relationships with certain individuals that would then go on to help support We English. So, right, to some extent, the stars aligned, and it meant that, you know, my wife and I could head off, and this time join with our 2-year-old, and begin making We English.
Mm. And you've talked about in the past, I think, the importance of making a journey, you know, making it a journey, because obviously you're at home already, as it were. You could just go in and out of these places. In fact, I was talking to last episode, I was talking to Philip Ebeling, who's a London, you know, photographer and has done a London book, and he did a little journey. Now, it's not on the same scope as yours, but the point being that, you know, he was going around the kind of edges, as it were, of London, and you know, he went and did a 10-day trip. He could have easily come home every night, but it had to be a kind of little adventure, really. That struck me, you know, that there was a kind of similar thought going on there. You decided it had to be a proper journey. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think if you look at my work, you can see where some of the influences lie, and that's with the American, some of the new topographics, but also people like Joel Sternfeld. And when I was looking at their work, I was thinking, you know, what stands out? And it was that idea for me of the road trip. Mm. You know, here they've hit, it's the classic American road trip. They've taken a motorhome, they've gone off and they've explored this vast territory. And then I began looking at the Becker School. And of course, both Hilda and Bernd had gone off in there around Europe in their VW. And even Robert Adams, of course, travelled with his family. And so it seemed to me that there's this rich tradition of the road trip in photography. And I loved that sense of embracing that and hitting the road. And also, it had worked in Motherland, the intensity of not returning and making work. I mean, I wasn't seeing film for 3 months at a time in Russia. I had no idea what was on the film until I went back to Moscow every 3 months and processed it. Right. And it worked because it kept me on edge, and it kept me pushing harder, and it kept me looking, and it kept me wondering. And so I thought, well, I'll try and do the same with We English. And also, just logistically, it was easier just to rent our house and just head off, right, you know, because financially it was going to be easier.
Yeah, and again, you could, I mean, this was pre-parenthood, so you...
We had our 2-year-old.
Oh, yeah, you had a 2-year-old.
And my wife
point.
Was pregnant as well. She was pregnant by the time we finished. Okay. So, I mean, it was a full-on... And also, we kind of liked that idea of being away while she was pregnant. So there was also...
Right,
and,
yeah.
And of course, we couldn't really do it once our 2-year-old would enter into,
yeah,
into
so you,
preschool. So it also felt like this was a lot, exactly. Yeah. Or a certain period where we could make it. And and we, you know, didn't really feel that we knew England. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew the Lake District very well because we'd go on holiday there, and I knew the South Coast. So my kind of memories of England were infused with these two particular landscapes, and I felt I wanted to broaden that. And, you know, the idea of the motorhome and using the motorhome as a platform, an elevated platform. So I began thinking more about having stricter rules about how I was going to make the work than I was in Motherland. Right. So there was the form of the work was very different, and that was deliberate. So the whole thing made sense to make it in this particular way.
Just out of interest, did the idea of getting high come out of the fact that you had the motorhome, or the other way around?
I wanted, because I was going to be looking at people in landscape, I knew from kind of the history of painting, you know, there's that kind of sense of the bird's eye perspective,
right?
The power play of having that elevation, and you, the viewer, being a surveyor of a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that this is something that I needed. And it was also influenced by some of the Becker School. Also, I've always loved Peter Belabrowski's book, Heimat, and you can certainly see echoes of that undeniably in my work.
Right.
And, you know, Peter was actually one of the masters on the masterclass, and he's somebody who I have a great deal of respect for as a practitioner.
Right.
I think he's one of the brilliant photography teachers in Europe. And
I don't know the book, but maybe I'll put
You'll know his work from Southeast Asia. He made the book about the tigers, where he photographed a number of these mega cities at night.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he's made a book, made quite a lot of work in that area, but he also made a book about Germany, about the German landscape, called Heimat, which is actually pretty similar to the word motherland, you know, Heim is the way that,
right,
that forms.
Right.
And so, yeah, there was a number of influences, but also I've always been a sucker for the Averkamp, Bruegel, Dutch, Flemish winter landscapes.
Mm.
And they've, you know, we had those cheap, what do you call them, calendars at home, you know, in the bathroom every year. You know, the different winter landscapes.
Right.
And so just that form, that aesthetic form of those tableaus, you know, where you're looking at naturalistic landscape, with these beautiful little narratives taking place within them, you know, whether it's the fight outside the pub, or the lovers holding hands ice skating, or the kid falling over, or the guy pissing behind the tree, or whatever it is, there's just so much to get lost in.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that I wanted to make work that the viewer could get lost in. So I needed bigger format than I'd used in Russia. I mean, I had toyed with shooting 5.4 in Russia, but it would just been totally impractical. You know, photographing in -35 on 5.4 was just ludicrous.
Yeah.
And also getting the film and
a headache. But you'd had some experience of that larger format, and so this was your first opportunity.
Yeah, this was the first opportunity to really use it. I was speaking to Tom Stoddard, who was another big influence on my work, because he was one of the judges on the Ian Parry Award. And, you know, at the time in the 90s, you know, and 2000s, you know, Tom was, well, he still is. I mean, he was a towering figure in photojournalism. And, and I was talking to Tom, and he was saying that he was going to start making some work about Britain as well. So we were both, saying he was going to make, and I thought, right, great. You know, this gave us an opportunity that there's somebody else that also felt it was important time to be making work here. Of course, he was shooting Leica black and white, and I was very different. But he was saying that how much trouble he was having, particularly on beaches, you know, that he'd never really found it before, that he, photographing abroad, you know, how much, not anger, but animosity.
No, I was going to ask you about that.
He'd sometimes get. So part of the reason for using the 4x5 is that I wanted the element of photography to be performative, to be theatrical, so that I was making a very overt statement that here I am, I'm a photographer, I'm making a photograph, and you might well be in that photograph. And if you want to not be in it, you can move, but I'm not moving.
So, exactly. You're sort of staking your space.
And also, we'll talk about staking claim. That's why, partly the reason why I created the website as well, because what I didn't want to do is spend a year of my life shooting this work to then find out that somebody had also done it and got a book out before me. So this was a marker in the sand that this Simon's making.
I'm doing this.
I'm doing this. And you can do it as well, but just so you know, I'm making a book, you know, I'm making this project about England now. And also it became a very important research tool where I could actually engage with the English. So I wanted to use it as an outreach where people could start a dialogue with me about inviting me to come and photograph things. And that became quite an important tool in terms of the process of making the work.
You created a website and you did, and I think it's something you'd sort of toyed with Motherland as well in terms of inviting people to be part of it in a way, but you invited people to suggest places that you might go to. Give me a couple of examples of, did you take those up very often? Those,
a few times, yeah. I mean, I probably photographed maybe 10% of the ideas.
Right.
And in the end, the ideas became more interesting in themselves as written text than me photographing it. So, I mean, there's a PDF on the website. You can download all the text now. But it was the way that people were talking about England. And, of course, we often think about nationhood as an imagined experience. I mean, Benedict Anderson used that term... imagined geographies or imagined communities, and that's that sense that somehow we remember an experience and of course it's maybe not quite actually how it was, and so that we think about England in a particular way, and which of course is very much tied into that sense of the green and pleasant land, in particular ways of how we engage with ideas of England through culture and literature and art. And what was interesting was that a number of expats started posting ideas, and it was I remember as a kid playing on this beach, or I have certain memories of this car boot sale, or whatever it might be. So there was this kind of echo of an experience or a moment in time, and I wanted to embrace that. And I wanted people to really feel that they could talk about an experience of England, which could be echoed in my photographs, but not necessarily purely represented in photographs. The other thing that I was finding was that, of course, I'd be in one part of the country and somebody would be suggesting an idea in another part of the country that was happening in a week's time. And just, I couldn't be crisscrossing the country.
Yeah,
so I managed to tie up a little deal with the Times newspaper, where in their T2 section, every week they'd publish a photograph that I'd taken that week of an event. And then it would tell you where I was going to be next week. So then you could follow me on this journey around the country suggesting ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, this is a readership of the time. So we have a certain demographic that I was engaging with. So I also tried to, I called local radio stations as I was traveling to see if I could do little interviews with them as I was on the road, and just to try and broaden the outreach. Or I'd go to the local newspaper because I wanted to open up the social network, if you like.
I was going to say, in a way, that was the other aspect to it, because it was you were a little bit ahead of the curve in a way, because it was quite an early example of what's very common now, which is to leverage sort of social media as a way to establish interest early on, while you're actually doing the thing, rather than after.
Yeah, I mean, this was before Kickstarter and those kind of things.
Yeah,
and
Facebook,
before
maybe.
Before the Sochi project and elements. I'm trying to think where... there had been somebody else that was doing something where I had seen... But it kind of was born out of Motherland, the Motherland website, which the Motherland website was basically started as a marketing tool to try and sell the book.
Mm.
But actually, I thought, well, it'd be quite nice to have a guest book where I could... Because actually, I couldn't get a publisher... Or I couldn't get a distributor in Russia, so it was almost impossible to distribute the book within that country itself. So I thought, well, if I put a form of the book online, I can at least send it to the friends that I traveled, to, and then they could give me some feedback. And then actually, that became quite an interesting process, which is where the We English idea came up. Well, why don't I try and get dialogue before I go rather than afterwards? And also, as I was researching, I was just thinking, God, I can't photograph the cheese rolling festival or these things that have been done so many times.
Yeah, you wanted to avoid sort of specific events to some extent.
Well, I didn't want to redo Homer Sykes.
No, exactly.
I wanted to echo these books. And if you look carefully in through the book, you can see
references.
Yeah. I mean, the most common example, or the one that jumps out most is the John Davies Agecroft Power Station. And I've taken that picture of the golfers under the cooling towers. And that's a deliberate nod, to John's work. And I photographed the Haxey Hood, which which Homer Sykes had photographed. But my picture's totally different from him, but I wanted that nod of reference. And of course, I did an opera. I didn't go to Glyndebourne. I went to another one. So there's a nod to Tony Ray Jones. And of course, there's a nod to Martin Parr and Sir Benjamin Stone. So I wanted to acknowledge these people who've important to British photography, but at the same time have my own way of, my own aesthetic and my own way of seeing the landscape and talking about what I was interested in.
Did the amount of interest that it generated in a way surprise you or please you? Did you feel like, you know, that was that something you expected particularly?
Well, what was interesting was actually I began keeping a blog as I was traveling, and I just started posting things about my research and bits and pieces about what I've been doing that week. But then the blog really took off when I got back, when I'd actually finished the work and started talking about editing. And suddenly there was this, you know, all these other people started emailing me and saying, oh, this is really interesting that you're talking about the process after having actually photographed. And so the blog became much more than just about the journey. It became about how I made this piece of work from the very beginning, about how I fundraised, to why I was using a particular camera, to what my interests were, to what my influences were, to then the actual making of the work, then to the editing of the work, then to the publishing of the book, and then to the exhibiting. So it became in itself this kind of organism that sits alongside the book.
Mm.
And I didn't consider myself a blogger. I mean, I've not done a blog since. It seemed to me that it was just important as a standalone website that had this life during that particular piece of work.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about editing. Do you have a particular, I don't know, process or something which you've established, or you know what? I mean, I'm not sure what my question is here. Everyone's got their own approach, I suppose.
Well, it is, for many, the most difficult part of a work, because you can say so many different things from the same series of pictures, depending on the final edit and sequencing and presentation of the work. I always work initially on my own for editing, so I'll get it down to, you know, maybe a 20th of what it was. So with We English, I shot about 2,000 plates, and I presented Chris with 500 images.
Right.
And we had then edited it together and got that down to... Well, actually, no, I think he told me to go away and come back with 250.
Right. He didn't want so much work to do.
Yeah, so I went away and, you know, with his guidance of, you know, what he thought was working and what I thought was working, and we got it down to a couple of 150. And then my wife's... he's a good editor. I mean, she's not a photographer, but she was there, and she, you know, she has a kind of good visual references, and so do some editing with her. I often work with assistants in the studio, and at the time I was working with Laura Panic was working with me, so she was a little bit involved. Then it really came down to printing everything out, so printed I think it's about 150 pictures. Actually, you know, what I first do is I print an A3 contact sheet.
Right.
So I create a book, a spiral-bound book. So I think there was 250 in that. And then I edit with these spiral-bound books.
Right.
And then from that, I print out 6x4, 6x7x5, about 125 pictures. And then literally just sat down with Chris and Bruno Sagel, who was working with Chris at the time. Bruno of
Be Happy,
self-published. Be Happy. Yeah. Sorry, Bruno. and yeah, but together we kind of edited it down and sequence kind of fell into place because it had to be chronologic. I wanted it to be
the seasons changing.
Yeah, and for me,
okay,
it was,
so that helped.
The weather
you out
was
the
really important for that piece of work.
So the sequencing, yeah. Well, yeah,
so there's only so much that you could jump in, and so you know that did mean that certain pictures had to be lost. And others brought in that maybe wouldn't have made it if it wasn't chronologic.
But the bottom line, I guess, is that you know, ultimately you can do the sort of bulk of it, but you need other people's input in the end, or it's not as useful to have other people's input when it
really
comes down to
it. I remember Chris saying that you can often take too much time editing. He's quite an intuitive editor, and you know, we had our battles, and there's a couple of pictures in there that I resolutely thought shouldn't be in there, and I'm now extremely glad they are in there. I mean, there's that, what is that phrase, killing my darlings? I mean,
yeah, murdering your darlings.
You also need somebody that hasn't invested that same stress and passion in the fact that you were stood in the rain for 3 hours to get that picture.
Exactly.
So there is an element of that. And of course, you know, if I edited the book now, I'd edit it differently. It's a moment in time. Some people ask me, will you republish Motherland? And if you did, would you change the order? And at the moment, I haven't got any plans to republish it. And if I did, I'm a bit torn whether I would change the order or whether I would change the edit, because it feels to me that it's actually representative of me at a particular time of my career. And it says something about what I was interested in at that moment and how I was thinking about photography. And if I made a major change, it would feel wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess lessons learned in the process of doing, well, both these big projects, but you know, perhaps We English, anything you would have done differently in retrospect?
No.
Right, well, that's good.
I can't think of anything. I mean, it was tough. You know, traveling with a two-year-old is not the easiest thing.
No.
But you know, it was a great experience, and it was really interesting to explore, you know, this country in a very different way. And what was weird was that at the time we were traveling, was between 2007 and September 2008, was the complete unraveling of the economic foundations of Britain. But nobody knew, really. You know, I mean, it was only with the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September 2008 that people really realised what it'd been going on since Northern Rock collapsed in 2007. And so it was kind of strange looking back at that work and just seeing a slight sense of unease in some of the pictures. And you kind of wonder whether that was a reference to
that's right,
kind of what was going on. And
this stuff was happening, as you say, behind the scenes without anyone really realizing.
Yeah, and if we look at what's happened since 2008, I mean, it's been a tumultuous 7-8 years. I mean, we've had the collapse of New Labour, we've had the emergence of a coalition government, we've had huge austerity, which, you know, which is in part still going on, and then now with kind of Brexit, and then in between this, peppered with various royal celebrations in the Olympics. So it's been this kind of quite a profound period of time, which I've really enjoyed being part of and making work about. And I think it's important that people still do make work that is about now. It is about subjects. It's not just about aesthetics or introspective. I think part of my problem with photography in the last few years is that it's become so nasal gazing, you know.
Navel gazing.
We'll get there in the end. Yeah. You know, that it's become too much about itself and not about reaching out. And I think to some extent now is an important time as any to be making work here in Britain. And also, what a shit state British photography is in terms of institutions. And we've got to kind of keep flying the flag and keep, somehow finding places that will keep showing work and keep collecting work. And, you know, with Birmingham Library being mothballed and all these kind of changes happening in the National Media Museum, it's being rebranded in the spring and the collection moving to the V&A. I mean, of course, it's the RPS collection that is, and who knows what's happening to the rest of the National Museum's collection. But, you know, this is an opportunity for the V&A, hopefully, you know, with more funding to start showing more and more photography. But yeah, it's a time that we do need to be thinking about what's happening to our crown jewels in photography. And you know, I think it's good we've got people like Red Eye who have just launched this photography collective network to think about the future of, you know, collections in Britain. And we still got some really strong people in the industry. You know, we've got the new generation of good picture editors, you know, people like Emma Balkett and Rebecca McClelland. So there is this kind of younger generation, and then festivals like Brighton and like, you know, what Louise is doing in Derby. So there are, you know, still people who are really passionate about what we can do and what we can show, and I think that's hopefully will be something that the kind of next generation continue with.
I think that's a good optimistic note on which to end it. And thank you so much for talking. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.